You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, cable news is a place where the line between news and opinion sometimes becomes blurry. A new book looks at cable TV's influence on us, our politics, and those in power. Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, The Retrievals is the newest production from the makers of the podcast Serial. It's been hovering near the top of the podcast charts since it came out. It follows the story of 200 IVF, that's in vitro fertilization, patients at the Yale Fertility Center, whose extreme and unusual pain during egg retrieval was dismissed by staff, only to find that one nurse had been replacing their fentanyl with saline. Now, the specifics of that case may be unusual, but many patients report to experiencing the story of their pain or other medical concerns being dismissed or overlooked by medical professionals, sometimes because of their gender, race, age, identity, or weight. Our next guest is an expert on patient-provider relationships, joining us for a look at the problem and advice on how to advocate for ourselves at the doctor's office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this situation where your symptoms, maybe pain symptoms, weren't taken seriously enough? Maybe because you think of your gender, race, age, or weight? Have you had your medical concerns dismissed only to find out, yeah, there was something there all along? If you're a healthcare provider, how do you make sure you get the info you need from your patient, that you're on the same page? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Karen Lutfi-Spencer is a professor of health and behavioral sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Like to think this never happens, that communication is always great between doctors and patients' needs are taken seriously. Do we have a sense of how common it is that it doesn't work out the right way?
Well, we think it's pretty common. It happens with all these different groups that you're talking about. And certainly there's this growing online presence where people are talking about this term medical gaslighting. So that leads us to believe that people are really concerned about it.
Who is most vulnerable to this this medical gaslighting, to doctors and nurses maybe not hearing what they're saying?
Sure. Well, we definitely think women and people of color in particular, and also increasingly trans people and any combination therein. So if you're female and non-white, that's, you know, even sort of a double jeopardy situation.
What are some of the reasons behind that, do you think?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of things going on. And some of them are at the level, of course, we have, you know, individual providers who maybe are kind of have racist or sexist tendencies, but there's a lot of smart, well-intentioned doctors out there trying to provide, you know, good healthcare and not do harm. So there's some things going on at the system level that kind of set us up for these problems and these biases. So for example, we have a long history in medicine of collecting data based on men and male animals and male cells. And we've kind of assumed for a long time, well, if it happens one way in men, it surely carries over to all these other populations. And what we're finding out is if something shows up in a way that is not the way it shows up in men, then that introduces a certain amount of uncertainty for doctors. And when there's uncertainty, it kind of invites people to fill in the gaps with stereotypes and bias.
Let's start with a couple of solutions to those problems. First of all, I think many of us have encountered that quick office visit. You know, it's not the doctor's fault. They've got another patient or multiple patients in waiting rooms right now. Would it help this situation just to add some kind of time to the doctor-patient interaction?
Oh, I think definitely, right? Doctors, it's just like us. If we go to the grocery store and you've got 400 things on your mind and you only have, you know, a short period of time to do your shopping, you're more likely to forget stuff. So I think if we kind of remember that doctors are in this system that puts a lot of pressures on them and it kind of invites, you know, problems in their decision-making, it raises the question for us as patients, like, what can we do to make it go as straightforwardly as possible once we get to the doctor, right? And I think one of those things is have a list of questions in advance. You got to make sure if there's only 17 minutes on the table, you want that doctor to understand in minute one or two what your agenda is. Because if you're going in saying my knee hurts and they spend, you know, the first 10 minutes of the session talking about your blood pressure or something that was on their agenda, then you have sort of a missed opportunity to get what you want on the table.
then with the issue of, you know, women presenting differently for certain conditions. I know strokes at an extreme level, heart problems might look different in women than men. There are different kinds of pain involved. What kind of training do we need out there for the medical profession to look at those things differently and not taking, as you mentioned, that research based all on men and trying to apply it to all women?
Sure. Well, at the national level, in terms of the National Institutes of Health funding research, they've started to really require that studies are diverse. You can't get away. You can't get $2 million anymore to do a study that's just all men. So that's good. And that's more diverse. That's pretty far upstream. But some of the things that I've seen in my research, for example, just taking the case of women getting missed for heart attacks, we would ask doctors, like, what do you think is going on with this patient? And they would say to me, this is just like this encyclopedia we learned in medical school. And I went and looked up the encyclopedia and like the angina entry. And there's a full page color illustration of a silver haired white man coming out of a restaurant into the blustery cold in the snow and clutching his chest. And I just think, well, why do we have to have a picture, an illustration of a man that they attach then to that idea of this is what a heart attack looks like? It's an old white man. When I think we could diversify those materials on that level too.
Talking to Karen Lutfi-Spencer, professor of health and behavioral sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver, looking at pain and other symptoms when we try to tell our doctors and nurses about them. Maybe not being heard, not being taken seriously, especially affecting women, people of color, and other groups. You could join in if you've been in this situation as a patient or a provider. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Karen, I want to talk about pain in particular, because in some ways it's a subjective experience. You can't plug in a painometer to measure pain. How can we make sure that we're communicating how pain is affecting us? And then on the other hand, how can providers make sure they're hearing that message about a patient's pain?
Sure. Pain is a really, you're right, it's very subjective. And so it's easy, it's open to being dismissed in these ways. And so, you know, some strategies for coming at this is maybe keeping a diary of your symptoms that you can share with the provider when you go in. So that gives them more detail maybe about when your pain happened, what you were doing before the pain got worse. That kind of goes hand in hand with making a list of questions in advance. I think also just sticking around and saying, like, I know my body and I know something is not right. I think there's more to this than what we just discussed today, or this is not normal for me. What else do you think might be going on?
And I want to talk now about people who are overweight or obese. Just reading up on this, anecdotally, a lot of reports of patients going in to see a doctor with a particular condition, having it immediately chalked up as related to weight and talking about diet and exercise. One extreme case, a patient coming in with abdominal pain, saying, oh, it's about your weight, and later finding out, no, it was actually a good-sized tumor that was causing this pain. Does obesity and overweight lead, in some cases, doctors to dismiss important symptoms?
There's definitely obesity stigma, and I think this is a growing area of concern and consideration and research, for sure. And again, it can be one of those things that's sort of a proxy. Like, I've had a doctor tell me, when I see someone who's overweight, I assume, and then they extrapolate from their weight to a whole bunch of other characteristics. Like, I assume they're not motivated. I assume they're not understanding what they need to do to maintain good health. So they can use this one piece of information as sort of a proxy for a bunch of other considerations.
We're talking to Karen Lutfi-Spencer, professor of health and behavioral sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver, talking to her about how we can better advocate for ourselves if we feel like we're being dismissed at the doctor's office, and how to do healthcare a little better to try to prevent that happening in the first place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been in this situation where you feel a doctor, say, dismissed your pain or your other concerns? Have you found a provider that makes you feel heard? And if you work in medicine and healthcare, what factors make it difficult to build trust with your patients? Have you found ways to, you think, be a better listener? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Karen Lutfi-Spencer, professor of health and behavioral sciences at the University of Colorado Denver, talking to her about what to do if we feel like our medical concerns or pain are not being taken seriously at the doctor's office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how to advocate for yourself or maybe a loved one at the doctor's office? Do you have a story about a time you successfully spoke up, said, hey, I don't think I'm being heard. Here's what's going on. How did that work out? Do you have advice for other listeners struggling with this? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Beth is with us in Mequon. Beth, hi.
Hi. This just happened to me last week. My husband and I went to a specialist. He found out he had cancer. We were having to decide on a procedure or not, and when I asked a question, the doctor would not even acknowledge that I was there to begin with and pointed to me and said, it's not your choice, it's his choice. I've been married for 43 years, so it is my choice too. I don't know what to say to him tomorrow when we go back for a procedure. So,
Beth, thanks a lot for calling in. So sorry you're going through this. Karen, now I know it's very common advice. You've mentioned it. When we're going in for something serious, bringing somebody like our spouse or someone else to help get, you know, make sure everything's heard, to help communicate. But in this case, Beth feels like as the person in that position, doctor doesn't seem to want to hear from her. What do you think?
That is a terrible story. I'm really sorry to hear that happen. So sometimes, especially like in a cancer center, you'll have a broader team of providers there. And so sometimes there's the oncologist, but there's also a social worker or other people who, nurse practitioners and people who are kind of, a little bit more focused on some of the social aspects that go around cancer care. So I would definitely take a look at who else is in the team that you might be able to talk to there. And if not that, then I would also consider asking about a palliative care referral. And so palliative care is just intended to, people sometimes confuse it with hospice and they're not the same, but palliative care is designed to improve symptoms and pain management all the way through care. So it has nothing to do with end of life per se, but those people sometimes also have skills to help you work together as a team because you need to be treated as a team member in that situation.
Thanks a lot for that call, Beth. And best to you, I hope you can find somebody you can communicate with there. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Speaking of teams, though, Karen, Beth is doing the right thing being there with her husband in this case in a difficult situation. I know when I get really bad news, medical or otherwise, my memory is not necessarily going to be great. I'm not going to key in on some of the important stuff. Can you talk about the importance, the helpfulness of sometimes having that buddy there with you in the office, spouse or whoever, to help catch some of those details that you might miss as you're focused on the bad stuff?
For sure. I think it's excellent to have someone there with you, and it serves multiple purposes. So when Beth goes home with her husband, you had another set of eyes and ears on the situation. And so you're providing moral support for each other, but you're also saying, did you hear that the same way I did? Did you understand that the same way I did? So if you're left with questions when you get home, that helps you formulate them. But also from the healthcare side, I think it sends a message that like, hey, look, he has someone at home who's really invested in how well he does. And they're paying attention and they're here and they are part of the team.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Pat with us in Sun Prairie. Pat, hi.
Yeah, I was saying that I went in for a Medicare exam, a physical exam for the year, and that's a real short exam. They sit you down, talk for a couple of minutes, and send you for a test. I don't really have anything wrong with me, so is that sort of a problem, you think, or not?
Pat, thanks for the call. I'm glad you're in good health, Karen, but that micro visit almost for a physical, are we just doing sort of an assembly line in some of these cases?
That's a really good question. And I think it speaks to like doctors have sort of sometimes or all providers, like they have sort of their own default agenda. They have their sort of checklist of things that they might want to get through in a physical or in an appointment. And they, again, like are in those short periods of time to work through a patient load. So that might be part of what you're seeing there, is that them just, they just have a default agenda. And so if you, again, have agenda items that you want to be asking about or a health concern that you want covered, then that's a good thing to be vocal about.
Thanks again for that call. Kay joins us now in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I've had a combination of things. First of all, I am elderly, and I was born severely premature at 27 weeks. And I've had problems all of my life. To make it short, I was laid on the right side of the incubator for 3 months, and therefore my left side was deprived of oxygen for 3 months. That extremely made all my muscles strained on my left side. My eye turned blind, and I now know the reason why. And I had two nutrition-related conditions, all of which I basically had to cure myself of. By stretching my muscles, my left eye was also turned out to the left.
Kay, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry to hear about that. How does this play out when you go to see a doctor now? Do they even ask about some of that background when you come in with a problem?
They only ask you of whether you've had any kinds of everything they call the disease. They don't ask you what your basic body condition is. If you have one bone out of place and strained muscles, that can have a severe reaction in your body.
Okay, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, and sorry you've gone through all that. But Karen, Kay feeling like doctors need to dig more into some of her longer-term health history to understand what she might be presenting with today.
Sure. I think that's a completely fair concern. And again, like if you feel like that's something that the doctor needs to know about, and if you have 17 minutes to meet with them and it's going to take them 20 minutes to get to that part of your medical history, I would, you know, try to set them up for understanding where you're coming from as early as you can in that interaction.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Cheryl joins us now in Lake Geneva. Cheryl, hello.
Hi, how's you doing?
Are you there?
Yep, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. What did you want to tell us about, Cheryl?
Well, basically what it is, I've had breast cancer 3 times. And the last time I went in, I had found a lump, and I went in, and they were like, no, it's not a lump, but we can do an ultrasound if you want. And I said, well, yeah, I do want. And then they came back and she said, well, really, I couldn't see anything, so it's not. And I said, well, I think I should probably get another ultrasound then. So then they did an ultrasound where they took a smaller wand so they could see more of a local place, I guess. And then I went back and they were like, no, it's not. I've felt 10,000 cases over so many years of breast cancer, and it's not. And they could tell I was not happy with that. And I pushed for the MRI, and then sure enough, it was.
Cheryl, thanks for the call. Sorry you had to go through that, but she kept pushing, she says, Karen, and ultimately the MRI did find that, yes, she was right to worry about it. Is that a situation where maybe given a past history of breast cancer, doctors might have jumped on that a little sooner?
Well, definitely. And I think it's an example of, like, just listening to that story, it sounds kind of mentally exhausting.
Yes.
To keep pushing and pushing, right? But then she persisted, and you can see what the outcome is. And I think that's one of the things that's really tricky about it, because when you don't feel well, the last thing you want to do is have to fight with the healthcare system that's supposed to be there to help you. So that's one of the things I get out of that story, is the persistence that I admire. But it's difficult.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for that call. In our last minute or so, Karen, are there changes you'd like to see in our healthcare system that can help avoid situations like Cheryl's and the general concept of medical gaslighting that we started out with?
Yes, I think there's things that we've been talking about things that we can do as individuals, but I think as a society, you know, this issue of we need more diverse data, different kinds of people in our studies, so there's not so much uncertainty when an unusual case shows up in the doctor's office. Having more diverse workforce, most of our doctors are still men and still white men, and we have more diversity, but I think we could use a lot more. And then a lot of those things about how the healthcare system is set up, just we have doctors are dealing with conflicting incentives around how to get paid and liability and patient well-being, trying to balance a lot of things increasingly. And I think that sets us up for some of these problems.
Karen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Karen Lutfi-Spencer, professor of health and behavioral sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver. We talked to her about how we can better advocate for ourselves as patients if we feel like we're being dismissed at the doctor's office, plus some structural fixes to make sure that healthcare providers hear our symptoms and have some time to hear about our symptoms and take them seriously. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, disinformation is a fact of life these days on social media and beyond. The author of a new book says we can learn to recognize it and counter it. Find out more from the new book on disinformation. And there's growing concern about the mental well-being of teenage girls, and a new Wisconsin report highlights that problem. We'll find out what's behind that and look at possible solutions. If you have a story to share from your own life, maybe as a healthcare provider or about someone in your own family that you'd be willing to share with us, you could do that right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, our romantic relationships, weddings, and some other big life decisions are often held up by financial realities. Find out how economics is changing our life paths in big ways. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the United States is seeing a record rise in rates of homelessness. We'll look at some of the big picture causes and solutions for homelessness in communities around the country. First, the company Signet Jewelers, which owns K Jewelers and Zales, told investors earlier this summer that sales of engagement rings had been down so far this year. Company executives said that part of it's economic, with higher inflation stopping would-be couples from purchasing expensive jewelry. And they say part of it's a ripple effect from the early days of the pandemic, when many single people weren't going on dates and meeting the partners they could eventually propose to. That's one company's view, not a detailed scientific study, but our relationship milestones often come with significant price tags that can bring economic realities into our love lives. We're listening back to a conversation about the financial costs associated with love and romantic relationships at every stage. You can join in by emailing ideas@wpr.org. What role have finances played in your relationships and key decisions? Have you delayed getting married or having kids or other milestones because of the costs? Have you found creative ways to save money in dating or marriage? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is the Vaughn Bascom Professor of Women, Family, and Community and a Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's also faculty at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. I talked with her about this last month. Here's a listen. Big picture, I think we like to think that love conquers all, but how big an effect do economic conditions and our personal finances have on these relationship milestones?
Yeah, this certainly couldn't be a less romantic topic, right? Good thing it's not Valentine's Day. But this is actually a topic that we spend a lot of time thinking about the role of individual finances and the role of larger economic circumstances in society and what role those play in the relationship decisions people make and the stresses that relationships experience. And by and large, we find that there's an association between these things across lots of different aspects of relationships, the partners we choose, whether or not we get married, whether or not our relationship is under stress, when and how we have children. So there's so many aspects to your question where we really do see connections between finances and relationships.
Something that's come up on conversations on the show here over the last few years is this idea of a marriage gap, or at least a long-term commitment gap, where people with college educations, higher salaries, more likely to find that long-term partner, people at lower socioeconomic levels getting less likely. Is that something you've seen?
Yeah, so we know that about two-thirds of people who've graduated college end up getting married, and that's compared to only about a quarter of people who stop schooling before graduating high school. So kind of looking at those ends of the, you know, educational credential spectrum, we see really big differences in marriage behavior. It's important that we don't equate that with finding a long-term partner, because one of the other trends that we've seen, especially over the last 40 years or so, are really big growth in what we call cohabitation, so living together outside of marriage. So people can find those long-term partnerships. Whether those last and whether they turn into marriage, though, can be a different question, and one that we do see a really big gap on based on education.
Now, we heard the jewelry company there blaming COVID in part on postponing relationship milestones, the dating, the engagement, the marriage for people. When you look back at the last few years over COVID, what impact do you see it having on our decisions to date and get married and things like that?
So I'd say, you know, what the company is claiming is not, it's not totally wrong. It's not totally the whole story. When there's a lot going on in the world, like financial turmoil of a recession or a pandemic, couples are more likely to delay making changes to their relationships. And that includes putting off marriage. It also includes delaying divorce. So during the early years of the pandemic, we saw about a 10% decline in marriage rates and divorce rates. So people sort of stomp the brakes, basically, when something big is going on and put off making those big decisions. That said, we also know that we've seen a long-term trend, not just during the pandemic, in people waiting to later ages to get married and a smaller proportion of the population being married. So we're seeing people being older and older when they do finally get married.
Do we have any idea what's driving that, either people not getting married or getting married later?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of factors that come together, and some of it does have to do with this starting premise, right, that we talked about it being really expensive to buy that engagement ring or have that wedding. So we do have these cultural ideas about what getting engaged or getting married should look like. And those have changed a lot over time. They've really ratcheted up. So we have this idea, I think, in our culture today that a big white fancy wedding dress and a large bridal party and a big reception, those are traditional things. And that's what a wedding should look like. So you have to have enough money to do those things. But that actually didn't become common until the last 50 years or so. Before that, people often had small weddings, sometimes just in their parents' living rooms. So as some of our cultural standards for what, you know, marriage should look like, what a wedding should look like, as those things ramp up, people often feel like they need to wait longer and longer in order to get married. So that's part of what's going on. The other thing I'd say is we have these changing views about what marriage represents. So Andrew Turlin, who's a really well-known family sociologist, he talks about how marriage used to be seen as the cornerstone of adult life, that piece that gets laid down before the rest of the building gets constructed. But now we see it as like the capstone on our adult lives. It's that piece that you put on the end after you have everything else set in place. So that means you have to have your job set in place, your finances, maybe you've even bought a house. And it just takes longer then to be ready to meet our cultural ideas around what marriage should look like today than it did in the past.
Talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin from UW-Madison, looking at the economy, finances, and our relationship milestones. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Compare yourself to, say, your parents' or grandparents' generation. Did you get married later? Why do you think that is? Are the costs leading you to delay doing something? Dating, finding someone, buying that engagement ring, buying that big fancy wedding, or did you economize on that? And hey, how about the cost of having kids? Have you considered that and maybe put off having kids in your own life? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, let's talk about the cost of having kids and childcare and how that's affecting people's decisions. What do we know?
So we certainly know that's a cost that's risen a lot. Our childcare market, basically in Wisconsin, but in the country as a whole, it really doesn't work. So there's really high demand, not enough supply, really low wages, and the costs are too high. So it sort of doesn't work for anybody. And that certainly can affect the decisions that some people make. But it can also, rather than affecting people's decisions about having children, it can affect the decisions people make about whether or not partners work, work part-time, work split shift. So it can affect family life in a lot of different ways. I think we, you know, can connect the decisions people make around having kids back to those larger conversations we were having earlier about feeling like there's instability in the world, feeling like you want to have your feet firmly under you before you get started having children. So all of those larger factors around finances can affect some of the decisions people make too. And for those people who want to wait until after they're married to have kids, as the age when people get married gets older, the age at which people have children then gets older, and the sort of time frame in which you can have kids before it becomes harder to do so can get smaller and smaller.
Yeah, in a way, when I think back, Sarah, there's always some kind of instability in the world if you look back through history, and there's always some kind of uncertainty about our life stages, our careers. Are these changes being driven by economic changes, or are these cultural changes in the way we think of these institutions?
You're totally right. There's always been, you know, different sources of instability on a global level and a local level, but our ideas around what family life needs to look like have changed a lot. And so I think that cultural piece that you pointed to is really important. In family sociology, we talk about this idea of deinstitutionalization, which is this huge word. And basically it means marriage is just less of a guiding institution in our society than it used to be. In family life, there are fewer and less constraining social roles and social rules, like all wives must do this or all fathers do that. And what that can mean is there's a lot more freedom. There's a lot less stigma around having your family look or function differently than someone else's family. But it also means that life is harder to navigate because you have to figure it out yourself. There's not just the way that everybody does things. And so we've seen those really big changes in our cultural ideas and ideals around family life.
Talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin, professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison, looking at the financial costs involved in our romantic relationships, the role that economics play in when and how we date, get married, have kids, and hoping you'll put a face on it, or at least a voice on it, at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share your experiences, did you put off getting married maybe longer than, say, your parents' generation did? What drove that? Did you hold off on scheduling that wedding till you could afford something bigger? Did the costs of childcare weigh into your decision of when and whether even to have kids? Join in with your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or were you like me and you economized and you got a $30 wedding ring and did in fact get married in your mother-in-law's living room? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Sarah Halpern-Meekin, professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. She's with us today to look at the role money plays in our love lives, from dating to marriage, to even having kids. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What role has money or finances played in your romantic life, or lack of same at some stages? Have finances influenced your decisions on when to get engaged or married or have kids? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I have what I think is a funny story to tell. In my, you know, when I went to college, we stayed up late at night talking about philosophical things like marriage and family and money and careers and stuff. Well, I eventually went into a low-income ministry where I worked with poor people, and I met a really nice lady that I really liked, and I asked her to marry me. And she goes, "No, I won't marry you. You don't have anything." I says, "Well, neither do you." And so we eventually didn't get married, but we stayed friends. But 30 years later, I found out neither one of us married, and we still don't have anything.
Jeff, thanks for the call. You know, Sarah, I think that question of, am I marrying a spouse who's going to make enough money on one side or the other, an eternal question and probably an issue these days, too.
Yeah, you know, what Jeff was speaking to, right, is this idea that what's okay in a dating partner might not be okay in a spouse. And so we see that people will do things like starting to cohabit together so that they can shore up their finances. But then we'll also see cohabitors saying they're putting off marriage because they're not financially ready for it. And what's so interesting there, right, is those people are already living together. So they're living together the same way they would be if they were married. But it's this cultural idea we have around what your relationship, what your finances should be like to make them marriage worthy. And when that bar is hard to reach, it can mean that people avoid taking those steps either short term or, like Jeff was saying, for the long term.
Jeff, thanks for being willing to share your story at 800-642-1234. You could join in and share your story of how you hit those milestones, whether money was a factor in who you dated, when you married, if you married, whether or not you had kids. Join in at 800-642-1234. Sarah, what are some of the biggest questions on your mind when it comes to these relationship milestones? As we have this post-COVID economy, what are some of the big unanswered things for you right now?
I think there's just a lot of really interesting trends that we're seeing. You know, as I was saying, we're seeing more people do family life in their own way, right? It's not just dictated by, you know, this is the one way to live a family life. And so we're seeing more variation in what that looks like. We're seeing more unmarried couples buy houses together. So about 1 in 10 homebuyers recently were unmarried couples. That's a really serious form of financial and long-term commitment, right? You know, you have a 30-year mortgage. That's a long-term commitment to each other. We see more people having children together outside of marriage. So about 4 out of 10 births today are to unmarried people. That, again, is going to be a lifelong connection you have with this other person. So you can get divorced, but that's always going to be your kid's other parent. And so one of the things that we're interested in is understanding more about how people navigate and create family life when they have to figure it all out themselves, because we don't have those strict norms telling us this is how you have to be a family.
And something you just mentioned reminded me of something you said earlier, and this is something I've seen in my own extended family, where people living together break up, keep living together because they can't afford to maintain two separate households. Again, I've seen this in my own extended family. Is that something we're seeing at large?
So we certainly hear those anecdotes. I think especially we'll hear it like in New York City, other really expensive cities where it's not possible to even find an apartment, you know, let alone live separately, that finances do drive these decisions. I know in some of my own research that we've seen that when people are living together and they do break up, they're more likely to get back together. So not moving out with each other sort of puts you in proximity, makes it more likely you're gonna fall back into bed together at the very least, even if not, you know, reunite long term. And so these financial decisions and circumstances really do shape the trajectories of relationships. And, you know, we can also talk about how they shape the stressors that relationships are under, because that's another component of what goes into this this mix of finances influencing relationships.
Let's go back to our callers now. Kara is with us in Waukesha. Kara, hi. Are you there, Kara?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi. Yeah,
go ahead. What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, so I kind of have something to add to it. I've got a partner that I've been living with for almost 10 years now, and we personally have made the decision not to get married simply for the fact that he had a harder time, you know, growing up, didn't have the best credit score, you know, in his young adult life, whereas I did have those resources available to me. So, you know, I actually went out, bought a house. We lived together under my mortgage, but we get a lot of pressure from the outside about, hey, you guys have been together. Why aren't you married yet? You know, when are you going to have kids, when it's really us making the decisions for ourselves financially not to get married because it's setting us up for success due to just one person having a better credit score than the other at this point.
And Kara, thank you for calling in and sharing that. Do you explain that to, you know, the family member who says, hey, when are you getting married? Or do you just kind of give them a quick, short answer, a none of your business kind of deal?
Pretty conservative Christian background. So I guess, you know, living out of wedlock is not something that's smiled upon from my immediate family. Whereas from his family, he comes from a Latin American background. So they're much more comfortable with us living together under out of wedlock, whereas my family is, it's a sensitive subject that comes up at holidays a lot.
Kara, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Sarah, there's that we're doing our family the way we want to, yet also facing, at least from one side of the family, some social pressure.
Yeah, and that really speaks to the way that we've seen a relatively rapid cultural change around this. And so you still have people who are more committed to those old cultural norms and people who are, you know, have moved on from being guided by those cultural norms. What Kara speaks to, right, is this issue around what does it mean for our finances to be united? And so, you know, when people get married, their credit scores do remain separate. So you don't take on your spouse's bad credit. But if you go to make purchases together and you're both putting your names on that car loan application or that mortgage application, then both of your credit scores are taken into account. So that's one of those times where joining finances can matter. There are other circumstances where getting married can be financially beneficial. So it can affect your access to your spouse's health insurance that they might have through an employer. It can be beneficial tax-wise for some couples. It can also be costly tax-wise for other couples, depending on what your earnings are like. And so there are lots of those individual decisions that, that couples need to make in considering how they're going to be together as a couple long-term and what that might mean for whether they come out ahead or face more financial struggles because of it.
Kara, thanks for that call. And Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is the Vaughn Baskin Professor of Women, Family, and Community and a Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison's School of Human Ecology. We listen back to our conversation with her about the ways finances and the economy can affect our romantic relationships and key relationship milestones. You can still let us know about your experience. How has money affected your relationships? What about your decision to get married, move in with someone, have kids? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org to share your story. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.